Ayo, he really isn't TMT afraid to die, A said Moody as we walked the rest of the way to the hotel that night. Ayo, he at TMM amazed every time I see it, but he really isn't TMT afraid. A when Saved by the Light was published, it became an instant bestseller, even before Brinkley did a press tour. When he started doing interviews, the book climbed higher on the New York Times bestseller list and stayed there. Then it began to appear on bestseller lists around the world. Brinkley a TMS story has become a cult classic. I think it's TMS safe to say that this book has caused a major change in attitudes about life and death. In the years since it was first published, I have heard tens of thousands of people testify about the power it has had over their lives. And I have received thousands of letters from readers who thanked me for putting Brinkley a TMS story into print, lauding it as a great exploration of the spiritual world. If you think about it, unique spiritual knowledge can be a heavy burden. Luckily, Brinkley gradually became more comfortable with the knowledge he learned on the other side and has happily shared it with others. One of the things he is most proud of is the Twilight Brigade, a volunteer hospice group he founded in 1984. It was one of the tasks given to him by the beings of light and is the main reason he thinks he was allowed to return to life. Since this writing, Brinkley has been at the bedside, with 367 dying veterans, including his father, through his work with the Twilight Brigade. He has logged 26,000 hours at the bedside of the dying. In addition, he has organized more than 13,000 volunteer caretakers across the country to help with these hospice efforts in Veterans Administration hospitals all over the United States. And on top of all that, Brinkley delivers as many as 100 public speeches per year, an amount of travel I find amazing for anyone, let alone someone who has been zapped to death by lightning and has a damaged heart valve. Oh yes. And let me add one more item to that list of spirit-requested tasks. Brinkley and his wife Catherine have written The Secrets of the Light, Harper 1, a book that further examines the prophecies given to him by the 13 beings of light who greeted him in the crystal city that Brinkley unabashedly calls A.E. Haven. All of the above-mentioned tasks require a lot of energy from Brinkley, yet he approaches each one with genuine enthusiasm. After all, angelic beings asked him to do these things after he died. Ayo, we've been good for each other, A. Brinkley said to me one night after delivering a fiery talk in Los Angeles. Ayo, on the way to helping me figure myself out, you figured yourself out, too. A. I laughed when he said that, knowing it was true. Brinkley has always been very generous in acknowledging my contribution to the book, his life, even some of the lines in his power-packed speeches. But the best of his frequently used sayings is one attributed to French mystic Teilhard de Chardin, who said, "Ayo, we are spiritual beings having a human experience. A, we all know what he means. Speaking of my own life, I have had the misfortune to lose family and friends. The thought that their spirits exist in a meaningful way after bodily death is comforting. And so is knowing someone like Damien Brinkley. To read this book is to know that he is unwavering in his beliefs. What are those beliefs specifically? Read this book and find out. I have no doubt that it will change your life in the way that just knowing him has changed mine." A. Paul Berry. 2008. Introduction. I first read of Damien Brinkley in an article in an Augusta, Georgia, newspaper. The story reported that a young man in a nearby South Carolina community had been struck in the head by lightning while talking on the telephone and had been miraculously resuscitated from a cardiac arrest. He was still alive but was hanging by a thread. He was in very critical condition, and it sounded as though he might not survive. The year was 1975, and my book Life After Life was about to be published. I remember wondering at the time if he had had a near-death experience. I filled the newspaper article away, thinking that sometime in the future I would check on his status and perhaps even look him up if he was still alive. As it happened, it was he who looked me up. I was giving a lecture at a community college in South Carolina on near-death experiences and my studies of people who had had these deeply spiritual experiences while on the threshold of death. During the discussion period at the end of the talk, Danyon raised his hand and told of his experience. He held the audience spellbound with his dramatic story. He told the people in the room that he had left his body after being killed by lightning and journeyed to a spiritual realm where love permeates everything and knowledge is as accessible as air. As he told his story, I suddenly realized that this was the young man I had read about in the newspaper. Afterward, I made an appointment to interview him and went to his home to listen to his story. To this day, Danyon Brinkley at TMS near-death experience stands as one of the most remarkable I have heard. He saw his own dead body twice, when he left it and when he returned, and in between he went to a spiritual realm populated by kind and powerful beings who allowed him to see his life in full review and assess his own successes and failures. Then we went to a beautiful city of crystal and light and sat in the presence of 13 beings of light who filled him with knowledge. Most amazing was the type of knowledge to which they exposed him. In the presence of these spiritual beings, Danyon said, he was allowed a glimpse of the future. He told me what he saw, all of which I considered to be nonsense, the ravings of a man fried by lightning. For instance, he told me that the breakdown of the Soviet Union would occur in 1989 and would be marked by food riots. He even told of a great war in the deserts of the Middle East that would be fought when a small country was invaded by a large one. According to the beings of light, there would be a clashing of two armies, one of which would be destroyed. This was would take place in 1990, Danyon insisted. The war he was talking about was, of course, the Gulf War. As I have already said, I considered his predictions to be pure nonsense. Over the years I have just nodded and written down what he has said. For a long time I thought that his brain was somewhat scrambled by the incident, and I was willing to give him a considerable amount of latitude. After all, I reasoned, who wouldn't a TMT be a tittle strange after being struck by lightning? Later it was I who acted like a person struck by lightning when I realized that the events he had told me about were coming true. How could this be? I wondered. How could a near-death experience lead to the capacity to see into the future? I didn't TMT know the answer. I have been a close friend of Danyon since we first talked in 1976. In those intervening years another revelation has made me feel as if I have been struck by lightning. Danyon Brinkley appears to be able to read minds. He has done this many times with me, he simply looked me right in the eyes and told me what was going on in the most personal aspects of my life. More important, I have seen him apparently read the minds of total strangers, telling them what they received in the mail that very day, who telephoned them, or how they felt about their spouses, children, even themselves. He doesn't TMT do this in the form of vague proclamations. Rather, he is incredibly specific. He once came into a college classroom where I was teaching and knew details of the personal lives of every student in the room. He was so accurate and specific in his readings that all the class members were gasping and some were openly weeping at his revelations. I must point out here that he had never spoken to a single one of the students before entering the room. They were all strangers. I have seen him read the minds of perfect strangers so many times that it has become almost commonplace in my life. In fact, I have come to cherish that moment of recognition when a persona TMS skepticism is replaced by awe, then wonder, at the realization that his most private thoughts are being read like an open book. How is it possible that a person who has a near-death experience is suddenly able to read minds and predict the future? In his book Transformed by the Light, Dr. Melvin Morse describes a study he conducted that shows that people who have had near-death experiences, NDEs, have 3 times the number of verifiable psychic experiences as do those who have never had NDEs. Their psychic abilities are not as profound as those displayed by Danyon, but they are measurable nonetheless. This study verifies others like it and proves that there is something about these deeply spiritual experiences that stimulates extrasensory perceptions in the people who have them. In the end, I admit to being stymied by Danyon Brinkley. At the same time, I am somewhat comforted by his story. It is, after all, a mystery, But mysteries like this one propel us forward in search of answers. A. Raymond Moody, M.D. 1. The first time I died. About 5 minutes before I died, I could hear the roll of thunder as another storm marched into Aiken, South Carolina. Out the window I could see lightning streak across the sky, making that sizzling sound before hitting the ground with the Popeye artillery from God. Someone in my family had called it. Over the years I had heard dozens of stories about people and animals being struck and killed by lightning. The lightning stories my great uncle would tell at night when the summer storms rumbled in and the room would strobe with bright flashes were as scary to me as ghost stories. That fear of lightning had never left me. Even on this night, September 17, 1975, at the age of 25, I wanted to get off the telephone quickly to avoid a phone call from God. I think it was also my great uncle who used to say, "Ayo, remember, if you get a phone call from God, you usually become the burning bush." But I am sure he meant it as a joke. "Ayo, hey Tommy, I've got to get going. A storm at TMS coming. Ayo, so what?" "Ayo," he said. I had been home from a trip to South America for only a few days and had planted myself on the telephone. I worked for the government and was also involved in several business concerns of my own. I owned and rented a number of houses, bought and repaired old cars, helped in my familiar TMS grocery business, and was in the process of starting a company. As the rain fell outside, I had to finish this last phone call to a business partner. "Ayo, Tommy, I gotta go. Mother always told me never to talk on the phone during a thunderstorm. And that was it. The next sound I heard was like a freight train coming into my ear at the speed of light. Jolts of electricity coursed through my body, and every cell of my being felt as if it were bathed in battery acid. The nails of my shoes were welded to the nails in the floor so that when I was thrown into the air, my feet were pulled out of them. I saw the ceiling in front of my face, and for a moment I couldn't imagine what power it was that could cause such searing pain and hold me in its grip, dangling over my own bed. What must have been a split second seemed like an hour. Somewhere down the hall my wife Sandy had shouted, "Ayo, that was a close one, ay," when she heard the thunder. But I didn't hear her say that. I only found out about it much later. I also didn't see the horrified look on her face as she peered down the hall and saw me hanging in midair. For a moment all I saw was the plaster of the ceiling. Then I went into another world. From immense pain I found myself engulfed by peace and tranquility. It was a feeling I had never known before and have not had since. It was like bathing in a glorious calmness. This place that I went to was an atmosphere of deep blue and grey where I was actually able to relax for a moment and wonder just what it was that had hit me so hard. Had a plane crashed into the house? Was our country under nuclear attack? I had no idea what had happened, but even in this moment of peacefulness I wanted to know where I was. I began to look around, to roll over in midair. Below me was my own body, thrown across the bed. My shoes were smoking and the telephone was melted in my hand. I could see Sandy run into the room. She stood over the bed and looked at me with a dazed expression. The kind you might fancy on the parent of a child found floating face down in a swimming pool. She quivered for a moment and then went to work. She had recently taken a course in cardiopulmonary resuscitation and knew exactly what to do. First she cleared my throat and moved my tongue to the side. Then she tilted my head back and began to breathe into my mouth. Three breaths and then she straddled my stomach and began pushing on my chest. She was pushing so hard that she grunted with each downward stroke. I must be dead, I thought. I could feel nothing because I was not in my body. I was a spectator of my final moments on Earth, as dispassionate about watching my own death as I might be if I were watching actors reenact it on television. I felt sorry for Sandy and could feel her fear and pain, but I was not concerned about that person lying on the bed. I do recall one thought that shows how far from pain I was. As I gazed at the man on the bed, I remember thinking, I thought I was better looking than that. The CPR must have worked because I was suddenly back in my body. Above me I could feel Sandy pounding on my chest. Normally, such bone cracking pressure would be painful, but I did not feel it. The electricity had coursed through my body, and there was not EMT a single spot on me that did not EMT feel as if it had been burned from the inside out. I began to moan, but only because I was too weak to scream. Tommy showed up in less than 10 minutes. He knew something was wrong because he had heard the explosion over the telephone. He had been a Navy corpsman, so Sandy let him take over. He wrapped me in a blanket and told her to call the emergency medical unit. AOEATMLL, do what we can, he said, placing his hand on my chest. By now I had left my body again, and I watched as Tommy held me and cursed the slowness of the ambulance, which we could hear approaching in the distance. I hovered above the three of them, Sandy, Tommy, and myself, as the medical technicians loaded me onto the stretcher and wheeled me to the ambulance. From where I hovered, about 15 feet above everyone, I could see the pouring rain hitting my face and drenching the backs of the ambulance crew. Sandy was crying and I felt sorry for her. Tommy was speaking quietly to the crew. They slid me into the ambulance, closed the doors, and took off. The perspective I had was that of a television camera. Without passion or pain, I watched as the person on the stretcher began to twitch and jump. Sandy was pressed against the side of the ambulance, withdrawing in terror from the sight of the man she loved convulsing on the stretcher before her. The emergency medical technician injected something in the body, hoping for some positive result, but after several seconds of painful convulsions, the man on the stretcher stopped moving. The technician put a stethoscope to his chest and let out a sigh. AOEATMS gone, he said to Sandy. AOEATMS gone. All of a sudden it hit me, that man on the stretcher was me. I watched as the technician pulled a sheet over my face and sat back. The ambulance did not EMT slow down, and the technician in the front seat was still on the radio to the hospital, trying to find out if there was anything the doctors wanted them to do. But the man on the stretcher was clearly dead. I am dead, I thought. I was not in my body and can honestly say that I did not EMT want to be. If I had any thought at all, it was simply that who I was had nothing to do with that body they had just covered with a sheet. Sandy was sobbing and patting my leg. Tommy was stunned and feeling overwhelmed at the suddenness of this event. The emergency medical technician was looking only at the body and feeling like a failure. 6. Don't you TMT feel bad, buddy, I thought. It ain't a TMT your fault. I looked toward the front of the ambulance to a spot over my dead body. A tunnel was forming, opening like the eye of a hurricane and coming toward me. That looks like an interesting place to be, I thought. And away I went. 2. The tunnel to eternity. I actually didn't TMT move at all. The tunnel came to me. There was the sound of chimes as the tunnel spiraled toward and then around me. Soon there was nothing to be seen, and no crying Sandy, no ambulance attendants trying to jumpstart my dead body, no desperate chatter with the hospital over the radio, only a tunnel that engulfed me completely and the intensely beautiful sound of 7 chimes ringing in rhythmic succession. I looked ahead into the darkness. There was a light up there, and I began to move toward it as quickly as possible. I was moving without legs at a high rate of speed. Ahead the light became brighter and brighter until it overtook the darkness and left me standing in a paradise of brilliant light. This was the brightest light I had ever seen, but in spite of that, it did not EMT hurt my eyes in the least. Unlike the pain one might feel when walking into sunlight from a dark room, this light was soothing to my eyes. I looked to my right and could see a silver form appearing like a silhouette through mist. As it approached, I began to feel a deep sense of love that encompassed all of the meanings of the word. It was as though I were seeing a lover, mother, and best friend, multiplied a thousandfold. As the being of light came closer, these feelings of love intensified until they became almost too pleasurable to withstand. I had the sense of becoming less dense, as though I had lost 20 or 30 pounds. The burden of my body had been left behind, And now I was an unencumbered spirit. I looked at my hand. It was translucent and shimmering and moved with fluidity, like the water in the ocean. I looked down at my chest. It, too, had the translucence and flow of fine silk in a light breeze. The being of light stood directly in front of me. As I gazed into its essence, I could see prisms of color, as though it were composed of thousands of tiny diamonds, each emitting the colors of the rainbow. I began to look around. Below us were other beings who looked like me. They appeared to be lost and shimmered at a rate that was far slower than the rate at which I shimmered. As I watched them, I noticed that I slowed down as well. There was a discomfort in this reduced vibration that made me look away. I looked above me. There were more beings, these brighter and more radiant than I. I felt discomfort when looking at them as well because I began to vibrate faster. It was as though I had drunk too much coffee and was now speeding up and moving too fast. I looked away. 9, from them and straight ahead at the being of light, who now stood before me. I felt comfortable in his presence, a familiarity that made me believe he had felt every feeling I had ever had, from the time I took my first breath to the instant I was sizzled by lightning. Looking at this being, I had the feeling that no one could love me better. No one could have more empathy, sympathy, encouragement, and non-judgmental compassion for me than this being. Although I refer to the being of light as AA, I never saw this being as either male or female. I have gone over this initial meeting many times in my head and can honestly say that none of the beings I met had gender, just great power. The being of light engulfed me, and as it did, I began to experience my whole life, feeling and seeing everything that had ever happened to me. It was as though a dam had burst and every memory stored in my brain flowed out. This life review was not pleasant. From the moment it began until it ended, I was faced with the sickening reality that I had been an unpleasant person, someone who was self-centered and mean. The first thing I saw was my angry childhood. I saw myself torturing other children, stealing their bicycles or making them miserable at school. One of the most vivid scenes was of the time I picked on a child at grade school because he had a goiter that protruded from his neck. The other kids in the class picked on him, too, but I was the worst. At the time I thought I was funny. But now, 10, as I relived this incident, I found myself in his body, living with the pain that I was causing. This perspective continued through every negative incident in my childhood, a substantial number to be sure. From 5th to 12th grade, I estimate that I had at least 6,000 fistfights. Now, as I reviewed my life in the bosom of the being, I relived each one of those altercations, but with one major difference: I was the receiver. I wasn't a TMT the receiver in the sense that I felt the punches I had thrown. Rather, I felt the anguish and the humiliation my opponent felt. Many of the people I fought had it coming, but others were innocent victims of my anger. Now I was forced to feel their pain. I also felt the grief I had caused my parents. I had been uncontrollable and proud of it. Although they had grounded me and yelled at me, I had let them know by my actions that none of their discipline really mattered. Many times they had pleaded with me and many times they had met frustration. I had often bragged to my friends about how I had hurt my parents. Now, in my life review, I felt their psychological pain at having such a bad child. My grade school in South Carolina had a demerit system. Students who received 15 demerits had their parents called in for a conference, while those who had 30 demerits on their record were suspended. In 7th grade, I had received 154 demerits by the third day of school. I was that kind of student. Now they call students like that AA hyperactive ear and do something about it. Back then we were just called A bad kids who were thought to be lost causes. When I was in the 4th grade, a red-headed boy named Kurt would wait for me every day before school and threaten to beat me up if I didn't TMT give him my lunch money. I was afraid, and gave him the money. Finally, I got tired of going all day without eating and told my father what was happening. He showed me how to make a blackjack out of a pair of my mother a TMS nylon stockings by pouring sand into them and tying the ends. A.O. when he bothers you again, hit him with the blackjack, A. he told me. My father did not TMT mean any harm, he was just showing me how to protect myself from the older kids. The problem was that after I bludgeoned Kurt and took his money, I developed a taste for fighting. From that point on, all I wanted to do was inflict pain and be tough. When I was in the 5th grade, I polled all my friends to find out who they thought was the toughest kid in the neighborhood. They all agreed that it was a stocky kid named Butch. I walked up to his house and knocked on the door. "Ayo, is Butch here?" I asked his mother. When he came out the door, I beat him until he fell off the porch, and then I ran away. I didn't TMT care who I fought, or how big or old they were. All I wanted to do was draw blood. Once, in 6th grade, a teacher asked me to stop disrupting class. When I refused, she grabbed my arm and began marching me toward the principal at EMS office. As we walked out of the classroom, I pulled loose and hit her with an uppercut that knocked her to the ground. As she held her bleeding nose, I walked myself to the principal at EMS office. As I explained to my parents, I didn't TMT mind going to the office, I just didn't TMT want to be pulled by a teacher. We lived next door to the junior high school I attended, and I could sit on the porch and watch the kids in the playground on the days that I was suspended from school. One day I was sitting there when a group of girls came to the fence and started making fun of me. I wasn't TMT going to take that. I went into the house, got my brother a TMS shotgun, and loaded it with rock salt. Then I came back out and shot the girls in the back as they fled, screaming. By the time I was 17, I was known as one of the best fighters in my high school. I fought almost daily to maintain my reputation. When I couldn't TMT find kids from my own school to beat up, I relied on the bad kids from other schools for competition. At least once a week we had staged fights in a parking lot near school. Students would come from as far as 30 miles away to participate in these fights. On the days that I fought, many of the kids wouldn't TMT get out of their cars, because after I beat up my opponent, I would take on a few spectators just for fun. These were the days of segregated high schools, and we would have great wars between blacks and whites. The black champion was a giant named Lundy. No one wanted to fight him after he beat the white champion in a savage 2-minute battle. Even I tried to avoid him, knowing there was no way that I could win. 13. One day we ran into each other at a hamburger stand. I tried to leave quickly but he stepped in my way. "Ayo, meet me tomorrow morning at the parking lot, Ayo," he said. "Aoe at EMLL be there, Ayo," I promised. Then, as he turned to walk away, I hit him with such force on the right side of the face that he couldn't TMT open his eyes for at least 10 minutes. As he lay struggling on the ground, I walked around him and kicked him in the chest a couple of times as hard as I could. "Ayo, won't TMT be able to make it tomorrow?" I said. "Ayo, so I thought I would take care of it today. I knew I couldn't TMT beat him in a fair fight, so I jumped him when his back was turned. That was the world I lived in through high school. 20 years later, at my high school reunion, a classmate cornered my date to tell her what kind of student I had been. "Ayo, let me tell you what he was famous for, Ayo," he said. "Ayo, he would beat your ass, steal your girlfriend, or do both. In retrospect, I couldn't TMT have agreed with him more. By the time I was finished with high school, that is exactly who I was. And by the time I had reached that point in my review, I was ashamed of myself. Now I knew the pain I had caused everyone in my life. As my body lay dead on that stretcher, I was reliving every moment of my life, including my emotions, attitudes, and motivations. The depth of emotion I experienced during this life review was astonishing. Not only could I feel the way, 14, both I and the other person had felt when an incident took place, I could also feel the feelings of the next person they reacted to. I was in a chain reaction of emotion, one that showed how deeply we affect one another. Luckily, not all of it was bad. One time, for instance, My great uncle and I were driving down the road when we saw a man beating a goat that had somehow gotten its head stuck in a fence. The man had a branch, and he was hitting the goat across the back as hard as he could while the goat bleated in fear and agony. I stopped the car and jumped across a ditch.